This podcast is part of the Democracy Group.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. We are talking politics and religion without killing each other. I am your host, Corey Nathan, and it is an honor to be a part of the Democracy Group. That is a network of podcasts that examines what's broken in our democracy and how we can work together to fix it. And apropos, we have a guest that will help us diagnose and prescribe just that very problem. So also remember, before we get started, remember to subscribe or follow depending on your app. And of course, I love those ratings and especially those reviews. The reviews in particular really do help. I'll put a link in our show notes to make it easier for you to do just that. Writing the review and all of it helps get the word out so more people can participate in the conversation like the one we're having today with Dr. Danielle Allen. Professor Allen is James Bryant Conant University Professor at Harvard University. She's a professor of political philosophy, ethics, and public policy, and director of the Democratic Knowledge Project and of the Allen Lab for Democracy Renovation. Outside the university, she is co-chair for the Our Common Purpose Commission and founder and president of Partners in Democracy, where she advocates for democracy reform to create greater voice and access in our democracy and to drive progress towards a new social contract that serves and includes us all. Now, before I hit record, I shared with Dr. Allen that we're almost exactly the same age. I'm feeling really intimidated, I have to tell you. You get a lot done in those same amount of years that we've been walking this earth. How are you doing? Are you tired or how's it going?
Oh, you're so sweet, Corey. No, thank you. Well, first of all, just thank you very much for having me on your show. I'm looking forward to it. I love the tagline, you know, talking about politics and religion without killing each other, the two forbidden topics. And here you are diving straight into them. So that is excellent. Mm. This age of AI has made avatars possible. So I feel like my answer to your question is just, I was an early adopter of avatars. So that is a part of the secret.
Yeah, just even some I forget where it was that you were describing it, but just even fitting in, you know, going walking the dog and, you know, family stuff and as a mom and, you know, you managed to fit it all in. So speaking of family, I thought that might be a good place to start. I am fascinated, as you describe in a couple of different places that I've read, those conversations where when you were growing up between your dad and Aunt Rosalind. So I was specifically curious for ways that you understood that they were striving for the same goals, but also they were obviously very, very different. I'd love to hear a little bit more about your dad and Aunt Rosalind.
Sure. No, I'd be delighted. So yes, I grew up in a super civically engaged family, a big extended family. My dad had 11 brothers and sisters. They had all grown up in Northern Florida on an island called Amelia Island, just a little bit north of Jacksonville. And about half of those 12 kids made their way to Southern California in the late 50s and early 60s. So that's another one of those migration stories as people were trying to leave the Jim Crow South and find true freedom. So they were all really, as I said, civically engaged. But what was striking was that they really were engaged across the political spectrum. So there was this one amazing year, 1992, when my Aunt Rosalind was on the ballot for Congress in the Bay Area for the Peace and Freedom Party. And in the very same year, my dad was running from Senate from Southern California as a Reagan Republican. So this wasn't, surprising because my whole youth, my whole childhood had involved family dinners and holiday dinners where the two of them would be kind of going at it, hammer and tongs. And my dad was a professor. He's now a retired professor. Always very professorial, sort of super skinny, smoking a pipe, pipe smoke curling around his head. My aunt, in contrast, was a big woman. She was a social worker, an activist, and gay. She was partnered with a woman from the 70s, sort of pretty early point before, marriage was legal for all couples, and had this huge belly laugh. And they just had these huge debates. They would go back and forth between whether or not, market liberties or public sector investment was the right way to approach solving a particular problem, or was it about civic virtues as a way to live a good life, or experiments in living, on the other hand. So there was this real sort of tug of war. But what was striking about the tug of war to me as a young person was just how committed they were to each other. That was sort of the first thing, just like this sort of deep human commitment. They always had each other's back. That was always clear. It didn't matter like what kind of trouble was just coming up, ordinary life trouble. They were there for each other. And so as a kid, I figured, you know, I had to kind of really reconcile these things. They were so obviously tethered to each other and yet also so intense in their disagreements. And it was sort of focusing on those two things that brought me to see that, you know, they'd both left the Jim Crow South. They both had a real clear picture of empowerment as what the goal was, not being subject to the terror of somebody perhaps jumping out from a tree to lynch you or something like that. So being free from that genuine kind of fear of domination. So they shared that. And so empowerment was this kind of central goal. And then they just had very different policy visions for how best to support and pursue that empowerment.
It's encouraging to know, as you describe it, they were committed to each other or always had each other's backs. And yet the way to arrive at shared goals could be so different. I'm curious, in your engagement now, your civic engagement now, it's almost a given that maybe not, it's within families, because so many families are fractured. You describe a loving spirit, you know, debating with a loving spirit, but whether it's within our families or even in our neighborhoods, in our communities, it seems harder and harder to do that. So how do you maintain that sort of loving spirit, as you describe it, or just being neighborly with those? Because a lot of folks, just by nature of me not being, you know, supportive of this candidate or that candidate, see me as nothing short of an enemy, and would even wish us harm. How do you maintain a loving spirit in that context?
Well, you know, I've learned to keep a loving spirit through trial and tribulation, really, and realized that a loving spirit was something that I needed for my own sake. So ultimately, maintaining a loving spirit is a selfish act, selfish in the right kind of way, I think. But in my case, what really happened is I found myself subjected to just a ridiculous amount of incredibly nasty email coming over the transom. Just all kinds of things, you know, you should be ashamed of yourself. You're despicable. How can you sleep at night? What kind of human being are you? And these were coming in for what I considered to be, you know, relatively speaking, pretty reasonable expressions of opinion. And I could I could feel in myself that the sort of negativity was affecting me. It was like making me a kind of tense and kind of angry person. And I didn't like that about myself. So I decided I was not going to let any of this nastiness hold my own heart hostage. I wanted to have a loving heart. I wanted to have a civil heart. So I took it on myself to just always respond to these emails with a positive gesture, sort of literally, thank you for your email. And here's what I think you're saying. Is that right? And then the most astonishing thing happened. When I started doing this, people would write back like real human beings. It was extraordinary. 9 out of 10 would then turn around and pivot and even apologize for having written to me in such a nasty way. So that, the fact that people, it was such a transformative thing for the conversations I was having with people, for me just to start with a loving heart, that has, you know, that's kept my loving heart locked in place ever since.
I want to dig into this a little bit more, and I could share some stories like right now, some of the things that I'm grappling with. You know, to your point, there are folks that strongly, strongly disagree. And I got a note this morning from a dude that I graduated high school with that we just disagree on certain issues. But he gave me credit for saying I always listen to him and make him feel respected. And, you know, we disagree on positions or something he said, but I don't attack him personally. And that means a lot, you know. So do you have certain practices to help you stay at peace or an even keel? Like I started meditating for the first time in my life a couple of years ago, and that's really like changed my brain. But do you have certain practices? Is walking the dog your thing, or are there other things that help you not like react and add to that animosity?
Well, I am a praying person, is the truth. And so when I feel myself getting angry or dark, I definitely pray. I pray for help, recovering an open spirit, a spirit of love, a spirit that's ready to bring light into the world. So that is the most important thing for me. For sure, yes. When I'm walking the dog, that can be a great time for me to lift up some prayers. So these things do go together. Absolutely. I was also going to ask, I'd be happy to share a couple of these email exchanges with you, if that would be of interest. Do you want me to read you a couple?
Yeah.
You want to settle back for story time? Okay. Hopefully, this one will probably take about 5 minutes to read. You can decide, you know, and I can also read a shorter one, but we'll start with this one, and I'll just anonymize the people. Okay, I won't use real names, obviously. And the other thing I'll do is I'll bleep a lot because there's an awful lot of, you know.
No, we have the explicit rating, swears. So feel free to be explicit.
All right, so I'm going to read you a couple that came in early November. The first one that came in was subject line, Israel-Palestine. Mm. And of course, it's directed to me as a professor at Harvard. What the bleep has become of your pathetic institution? Your mind bleeping our youth into supporting Hamas. You bleeped, bleep, loser, bleep. Intellectual bleep, bleep at its finest. If the radicals gain the upper hand, you realize they'll be coming for you, ivory tower idiots, first. And me as average middle-class white guy won't save you dumb bleeps this time. All right, so that's
a lot of bleeps.
That's a lot of bleeps, exactly. No sign off, you know, no name or anything. But anyway, it was in the from line. Dear Mr. Elliott, thank you for your kind note. I wonder if you've taken time to read my own contributions on the subject. If not, you'll find them here. There's a link to one of my Washington Post columns. Best wishes, Danielle. And then comes back the next one. I don't care what your thoughts are.
Oh my goodness.
Those are all caps when I'm shouting like that, okay? I never allow my sons to go fight and possibly die for your upper class, sorry, bleeps. From one who is not a Trump psycho and voted for Hillary and Joe, just so you know what real people are like. Dear Mr. Elliott, it seems that you don't care what I think, but are focused on my symbolic role. Is that right? Thanks, Danielle. Yes, what you represent, not you personally.
Oh.
A completely out-of-touch Harvard elitist who thinks the silent majority will stay silent indefinitely. I don't want a messed up future for my progeny being the average middle-class Jane Doe and John Doe, who always pay the price most dearly for the poorly thought out social engineering plans of the upper class. We pay in blood for those mistakes. I don't want my children or grandchildren paying in blood one day in the future for know-nothing intellectuals who encourage sleeping with the enemy. This is the most basic form of good and morally right versus bad and morally wrong, period. Mm. If a tenured Harvard professor can't understand this, then we're heading down a dark path. Your colleagues have promoted this gray area morality code for far too long, and now our young people are stuck in a fog of your making, a fog that will demand more from them than their young hearts can ever imagine. Dear Mr. Elliott, I'm glad I've understood you correctly. Thanks for letting me know. I'm also so glad that in this last message, you've dropped the use of swears. I have to admit that I never really enjoy it when people swear at me. I really appreciate hearing your thoughts without swears in them. At any rate, I get that you see that your children's lives are being messed up by social engineering elites. I often complain about the problem of elite technocrats not paying any attention to how their grand ideas actually affect the lives people have the chance to leave. I do know that this is a problem of the place where I sit. I agree with you. In your message below, you wonder whether a tenured professor can understand the difference between right and wrong. What would you think of making a judgment about this tenured professor, the one you've written to, by reading the Washington Post column that I wrote on Israel and Gaza? Here it is. Link again. Thanks, Danielle. Danielle, I finally read your article. Thank you for sharing. It reaffirmed what I want to be, but often fall short of being, especially when dealing with such sensitive, emotionally charged issues. My apologies for the bad language. I honestly wrote it that way more as an attention grabber with the hopes of stirring up reaction, but never really anticipating a response. It was more like a cry of anger into a void, and I never expected to hear a reply, but only hoped someone might read it and think about how the silent majority in this country often feels, unheard and unrepresented. Also, as I heard more in-depth stories of what happened to these Jewish civilians, I identified so strongly with them, just as if it were my own wife or sister or daughter in that situation, and it brought out such a primal anger in me. Then to hear that our own institutions of higher learning were, in my opinion, indoctrinating our youth to think so one-sided on the issue, as opposed to teaching them critical thinking skills, it all just had me fed up and exasperated, honestly. but your calm and non-confrontational tone gave me pause, and I sincerely thank you for that. And thank you just for responding and doing so in a thoughtful way as opposed to a flat, robotic response. This interaction has been very good for me and will inform my future interactions in the future. Sincerely, kindest regards, Leo.
Yeah, Mr. Elliot.
Exactly.
That's so informative. And it, by the way, it's very timely. I just shared an episode that we just shared on this very topic. A buddy of mine, longtime friend of mine, reached out to me in the weeks after October 7th. And folks who listen to this program know I have family there. I grew up very observantly Jewish before becoming a Christian in my late 20s. But he reached out, and his first query was, I'm just wondering, since those, you know, how you feel about those that you ally yourself with, that you're aligned with, are basically advocating for the murder and cheering on the rape of you right. know, your brethren in Israel. And I didn't respond nearly as productively as you did. Normally, I actually do. Normally, I lead with curiosity. This great writer and activist, Mani Guzman, I never thought of it that way as like the disposition right. that I try to hold. But that one, I said, dude, first of all, this is really upsetting, partly because, like, really, you're taking a victory lap now for Trump? Like, now? Right. This is the time? But second of all, you obviously don't know what my views are. You know, right. so that guilty by association thing, I didn't disarm him nearly as productively as you did. And it only got elevated over time. So I give you, especially on such a charged issue, it's amazing how each response that you received from him was one step of de-escalation. Mm-hmm. The other thing that strikes me about what you shared is that, I've been stretching and reading some of your longer written work, like the last year's book, Justice by Means of Democracy,
right. which not is not beach reading that, no.
no, but it's important because it's accessible enough for a relatively uneducated guy like me. It is hard, but mm-hmm. it's accessible enough. But it's a different kind of writing than you do, say, for the Washington Post.
Yes, it is. You know? That's right. Yeah.
And then I recognize some of that creeping in, even on some of the endeavors that you're involved with, where I don't know, for some reason, one of the mission statements or something like that, it's the word gnarly was used. I'm like, oh, cool. That's all right. She's talking to me now. You know, or messed up, as you said exactly. to Elliot, if we right. so-called Elliot. So. There's mm-hmm. a lot there. Before we move on, I wanted to tell you about something else that's important. Money. Specifically your money. In all seriousness, I wanted to tell you about my advisor and my friend, George Meza. George runs Meza Wealth Management. And with George, it's not just about money. It's about helping us manage our present and plan for our future. And unlike a lot of other firms out there, George and I actually have a relationship. He knows me, he knows my family, and I know his wonderful family. I also know his firm and the incredible team he's put together, from his chief investment officer to some of the other great people in his office, like Jessica, their head of operations, that are always there to help me and with all aspects of our portfolio. You see, the thing is, I got a lot going on. I guess we all got a lot going on, and I don't have the time to watch our investments all day, every day. And even if I did, I don't have the experience and expertise that George's team collectively has. So we get the entire Meza Wealth Management team, all their expertise and all their integrity. And again, it's based on George knowing me personally, knowing my goals, and even the kind of risk that's appropriate for me to take, which, by the way, could change from one season to the next. And they're on top of all of that. So if you want George Meza and Meza Wealth Management to be on your team, just visit their website, MezaWealth.com. That's M-E-Z-A Wealth.com, www.MezaWealth.com. And that will also be in our show notes, so you can check that. And now, back to our show. One other thing I did want to ask you about, as I was learning more also about your family's history, that was one of the things that came to mind just this week when I was thinking about that negative interaction that I that I had. So many go well, so I should say that, but we do have a negative bias
but
typically.
It's hard. No, exactly. Just sorry to interrupt you briefly, but
yeah,
being able to maintain that loving spirit, as you asked, I can see why you asked about it, because it's hard.
It
right?
is.
And you have to maintain it through trial and tribulation is the truth.
Yeah.
And for that, one needs help. One needs all kinds of external supports in order to do that.
See, and one of the things that I wanted to ask you about is kind of a long way around the barn. Sorry about that. But I did want to respond to that, to what you read, is your family's history. You talked about your dad and your Aunt Rosalind, but it goes further back than that. Your great grandparents on your mom's side, your grandfather and your dad's, like you have people, you got family history. Would you mind sharing some of that?
Sure. No, I appreciate it. So I am, you know, notably obsessed with democracy. You know, that's a thing people, it's kind of hard to miss about Danielle. Danielle cares about democracy. Okay. And it kind of really raises the question, why, how does anybody get to be that obsessed about democracy? I mean, you know, yeah, I can understand being reasonably obsessed, but 24/7 is sort of all you think about. And, you know, I'm not just thinking about candidates or politicians. I'm thinking about self-government and the idea that institutions are supposed to help us live better and have a healthier society together. And these are kind of abstract questions. So, you know, you start banging your head about this, you know, why is it exactly that I have this deep obsession? And I came to realize it's in the first instance, just in a very deep way, a matter of family inheritance. Because I do on both sides. I think this is what brought my parents together. They came from people who were told something was impossible, refused to accept that, and did something about it. So my great-grandparents were told that women having the right to vote was impossible, and they refused to accept that. And for them, the only question was, how could we make this possible? It was a necessary thing. Similarly, on my dad's side, you know, my granddad was told in many, many ways that social equality for African-Americans in the South was impossible. And he refused to accept. They said, no, not only is it possible, it's necessary. So the only question is how. And that clarity they had, that their own thriving, the well-being of their families and their communities did depend on access to steering rights, the chance to be a person who helps to create the world that we're all living in together. That was a kind of a deep and profound insight that they held on to. And I think they've passed on in our family. So yes, I do come from generations of people who have loved and fought for democracy. They've done that because of a really direct sense they have of how human thriving depends on that chance to chart your own course in life, both in your private life, but also as a member of a community, steering a whole community together.
Right, right. And just as one example, I think it was your granddad who helped to start the NAACP in Florida.
One of the first chapters, exactly, yeah, in Northern Florida.
And that was pre-Jackie Robinson. That was pre-Dr. King's movement. So he was putting himself in great peril, right?
Yep, lynchings were on the rise at the time. So it was definitely a matter of taking his life in his hands. So I think about that a lot. You know, people will these days say, well, gosh, you know, isn't it discouraging to do work on democracy? And don't things look so bleak? And really, you know, why do you keep at it, Danielle? And I just have to remind myself, you know, my granddad literally took his life in his hands. Like, I'm not taking my life in my hands. It's not that bad, right? So yes, things are bleak, but the truth is I'm not taking my life in my hands. So I don't have to in order to do serious work on democracy these days. And so I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for what those generations built that make that true. But it also means, you know, there's no point slacking because, you know, we have it easy, actually, comparatively speaking.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to take a second and geek out a little bit. And I don't even know if I can pronounce this correctly, but you describe yourself as a eudaemonist democratic pragmatist.
Yes. So, good.
Did I pronounce it right?
You did very well. I mean, it comes from the Greek. So okay. Aristotle is the sort of first theorist of, as we would say it in Greek, eudaimonia. People say it all in all kinds of ways in English. But what that word means, the literal Greek means that there's a sort of blessed spirit, basically. Eu means well or good, and daimon is what we get demon from, but it had a positive meaning. So it means you had some sort of good spirit around you. So the goal in life was to achieve eudaimonia. We broadly translate that as happiness these days. And for Aristotle, this wasn't a sort of cheap hedonistic conception. It was really a concept of well-being or flourishing. So I am oriented by the pursuit of flourishing for human beings. How can individuals thrive? How can communities thrive? And in order to try to answer that question, I do believe in our experimental powers as human beings, that we keep trying things to find that path to flourishing. And then we can learn from our mistakes and then improve. And that's what makes me a pragmatist. Mm. So it's that's how those two concepts go together.
I love it. Yeah, I try to impress some of my friends. If they say, well, are you a libertarian? I say, I'm a Thoreau-esque libertarian. You know, I try to get really in the weeds yep. a little bit, or a Burkean yep. conservative, you know. But you take it to a whole other level. So
yes. That was partly, you know, that was a good sort of little inside joke, though, too, right? To produce a label like that for yourself. Slightly tongue-in-cheek, put it that way.
Fair enough. So I thought a good way to contextualize the more topical part of our conversation is by maybe trying to diagnose some of what's some of the threats, frankly. And mm-hmm. if we look simply at the First Amendment and the five freedoms guaranteed there, speech, religion, press, assembly, and the right to petition the government, in what ways have we already seen those basic freedoms threatened? And in what ways, not to get you caught up in, you know, the day-to-day news cycle, but in what ways do you think these five freedoms can be further deteriorated, not just under a second Trump term, but you do a lot of work on our civic education, mm-hmm. our civic engagement. So not just that individual, but us as a polis, how can it further be deteriorated?
So it's a great question. And I think one of the interesting things about thinking about the First Amendment is that it sort of gives us a chance to think about two things. First of all, what are the rights we need in order to be able to express ourselves, articulate our own positions on our government's policy, and then actively pursue change from our government on the one hand. On the other hand, there's a second sort of theme that's not directly in the amendment, but which is related, and that's about the sort of health of our information ecosystem. So in other words, in order to petition the government, in order to assemble and so forth, one wants good information. One wants access to understanding about what's happening in one's government. I think that second thing, honestly, is where we're more challenged right now, as opposed to there being restrictions on our rights. So take, for example, the disappearance of local news and the spread of local news deserts around the country. There's research that indicates that every place those local newspapers are disappearing, we are in all probability seeing a rise in corruption of various kinds, because it's not possible to hold people accountable. It's not possible to hold elected officials accountable if there isn't press coverage. So we're at a point, I think, where the danger, honestly, may be a little bit less about impositions on our individual rights of speech and more on whether we can provision the public good that we need of a healthy information ecosystem.
Right, right. So you do deal with different threads that you can pull on that very theme. One I haven't discovered yet. I know that you've written about it, but I haven't. There's a lot to dig into. You're not ubiquitous. What's the word? Prolific.
Prolific.
You're exactly, prolific. Yeah. So I haven't gotten quite that far. But I, you know, one way in terms of the news, I was wondering, has someone like Rupert Murdoch or Fox News, again, not to nail you down on individuals or individual outlets, but it seems like Rupert Murdoch's, maybe if he read Madison's, you know, Federalist 10, he's like, yeah, okay, I could break that, you know? I'd love for you to comment on that, but more importantly, how do we fix it?
Yes, no, that's a great question. I mean, I think Rupert Murdoch was very intentional in building something that was meant to disrupt the existing media ecosystem. I mean, he published a lecture in the early 90s that you should track down if you haven't seen it. And I'm forgetting the title right now, but he was explicit about the desire to upend the existing media infrastructure. His motivation, as he described it, was to meet appetites he saw, you know, in the world that were unmet by the traditional media infrastructure. He believed there was a big market in that early lecture. The motivation seemed honestly to be primarily economic, but it was definitely, you know, an economic motivation at the expense of social health. So economic motivation trumping questions of community well-being and the like. So I think that's a large part of the story of media, not just Murdoch, but over the last 30 or 40 years, is that the commitment to outrage, to anger, which drives revenue, has trumped questions of what's actually good for society.
Right.
So that's one theme. Secondly, there's the accidental breakage created by social media. And there is just a really simple idea that, you know, when our representative institutions were designed in the 18th century, there were a few different premises to what was supposed to make them work. And one of the premises was that geographic dispersal was actually supposed to help them work.
Right.
The idea was that, you know, that it would be hard with people, for people with extreme views, to find each other.
Yeah.
So they would have to go through representatives to get their views into the public sphere. So there would be this like filtering process that would happen that would keep extreme factions from forming. And social media disappeared, obviously, geographic dispersal, right? So folks with extreme views can find each other super easily. They can coordinate. They can get their views into the public sphere. They can capture elected offices and things like that. And that's incredibly destabilizing for us. So that's really where I see our greatest challenge.
So I was fascinated by that because I hadn't put it in that, I didn't historically contextualize that way, that the geographic dispersal provides a very natural topographical filter for our freedom of speech, frankly. I've wondered, and this is my cynic, I've wondered with, if you read even three or four comments to the typical, you know, column in the Washington Post, you would think, I'm really questioning my belief in the freedom of speech now.
I see. That's where your question was coming from.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Sort of. I mean, what? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, how do we do that? Do we have to issue freedom of speech licenses the way we have driver's licenses, or, you know?
So no. So I do think it's an interesting and hard question, because basically what we're saying is there was a structure in the very beginning where freedom of speech was empowered, but at the same time, there were breaks. There were natural breaks on it. And now the breaks are gone. And so we are seeing, you know, everything that crosses through anybody's mind is suddenly in the public sphere. And obviously, not all of it is meritorious. So what do we do about that? What does it mean when we're swimming in lots of non-meritorious stuff? And to some extent, I think we do need to redesign some breaks, but we can do that without actually limiting freedom of expression. The redesign that I like best is ranked choice voting.
Yes.
So this is when, you know, when you go to the polls, instead of voting for one person, you put your first choice, your second choice, your third choice, depending on the election, however many choices. The advantage to this is not just about how it changes my voting experience or your voting experience. It's also about how it changes the experience of a candidate. So imagine if you're a candidate running for office, and now when you're out there on the stump, you want to be all those people's first choice vote, but you want to know what? You want to be other people's second choice vote too.
Right.
So suddenly it doesn't help you to demonize your opponent. In fact, you might even go knock on the doors of some people from the other party than you, just because you actually want to be a second choice for them.
Right.
So that changes the incentives you have for how you're campaigning, for the messages you're putting out there. That teaches all your supporters a different way of engaging with people who support a different candidate. And so you see, we can change the quality of what is articulated in the public sphere without actually limiting anybody's opportunity to express themselves.
So I loved that part. I think there was maybe one of the columns last year in your series that you, by the way, I'm going to try to figure out which of, maybe it's just the first column that I'll link to so folks can follow there are 9 or 10 that you wrote last year about this. But there was one that dealt with some specific examples, and I loved how you pointed out 2022 Alaska.
Right.
Great example where the member of Congress is a Democrat as opposed to Sarah Palin, who we could say, especially at this point, has evolved into quite an extremist.
Right.
Or the Senate, Senator Murkowski is a right of center Republican, as opposed to some of the extremists that were going to try to primary her. But Alaska, now what particular type of, it's not necessarily an open, it's not an open primary. It's a ranked
all
choice
candidates.
Voting.
Well, so in Alaska has a beautiful model. It's a hybrid model, really.
Yeah.
So The first stage of it is an all candidates primary.
Right.
No more party primaries. All the candidates with their different party labels run on the same ballot. So you step into that voting box and you get a ballot and you could pick a Democrat or a Republican or an independent or a green. All those choices are together in one place for you. You pick one on that first primary ballot, and then the top four vote getters go on to the general election. Then when you get to the general election, that's when you rank your first choice, your second choice, your third choice. And it's an instant runoff. Okay.
Right.
Nobody gets over 50%. The bottom person drops out and their voters have their votes reallocated to their second choice selections.
Right. Yeah. And there's 50 different experiments happening right now. I live in California and it's often referred to as a jungle primary, but I forget the way that you described it. It's a much better description.
All candidates primary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so the Alaska model is 2.0 on the California model.
Okay. All right. Terrific. Right?
Because California, you guys just take two people forward. There's some problems with that. So four is better than taking two forward.
That's true. Yeah, I could see that. Even just in my house district, it ends up becoming the Republican and the Democrat. And yeah, it's not perfect, but hopefully some of these experiments will, you know, go trickle up, if you will, to the federal level. I did want to ask you about the Democratic Knowledge Project. The division, as you described, is for a supermajority of our population to believe that democracy is essential and that they have the knowledge, capacity, and tools that they need to participate in civic life. That's an inspiring, although big, it's an ambitious vision, but it indicates that we don't currently have a supermajority. So in your experience, where are we now and how do we get there?
Yep. Well, this is, for me, what's been one of those, you know, the data points that keep you up at night. this is the sort of the data about the difference between rising generations and their connection to democracy and older generations. So for the cohort born before World War II, about 74% of that generational cohort consider it essential to live in a democracy. In contrast, for millennials and younger, so low 40s and younger, not quite 30% consider it essential to live in a democracy. So that's where that concept of the supermajority comes from. We know what the high watermark is.
Yeah.
It's when a supermajority, you know, thinks it's essential to live in a democracy. And then that means they have confidence to participate as well. And we are at, you know, I don't know if it's a low watermark. I hope it's a low watermark. I hope we are sort of hitting bottom and we can turn it around. But that's basically the idea and the goal, that for rising generations in particular, we need to reconnect them to our democratic institutions. It's not enough just to exhort people to participate, because right now stuff's pretty darn dysfunctional.
Yeah.
So when you exhort people to participate in something dysfunctional, that just produces more cynicism, honestly, by the end of the process than you had when you started.
Right.
So that's why for me, it's so important to do work on actually renovating our institutions at the very same time that I'm doing work on civic education. When I invite kids to participate, I want to be able to say, yes, and the thing I'm inviting you to participate in, like, it's rock star quality and it's worth your time. So that's why for me, the two lanes of work have to go together.
That makes sense. So you talk about the cynicism and the dysfunctionality. I was curious what kind of specific, what kind of resistance have you found with this kind of initiative? Say just in the public K through 12 schools. And do you find there are certain states or certain districts where you've met with greater obstacles than others? And, you know, what kinds of objections have there been?
Sure. Well, so I run the Democratic Knowledge Project focuses on Massachusetts specifically.
Okay.
And we're really fortunate because in 2018, Massachusetts decided to reinvest in civic education. So we're working in a context where people want more civic learning opportunities and haven't had the resources or opportunities to develop them for school curricula recently. So we're kind of filling a vacuum in Massachusetts. So there's been really active and supportive uptake. So that's great. In addition, I also work on something called the Educating for American Democracy Initiative. This is a national endeavor. It was a framework for excellence in history and civic learning for all learners K through 12. It was developed by this huge network, 300 people from across the country, diverse with regard to viewpoint, background, demography, geography, professional expertise, the whole thing. And so that, you know, we have implementations underway in 14 states. And for sure, there are definitely differences, red states versus blue states and the like. And right now, I think it's fair to say there's a kind of substantive battle on the ground in educational space between the vision that comes out of Ron DeSantis's education department plus Hillsdale College in Michigan. They're really trying to revive classical education, go back to the Greeks, let's, you know, really work through the classical texts and things like that. We think those texts are super valuable, but we also think that they're not everything. And so you need that, yes, but you also need a full picture of the whole history of the country. Good and bad both come together. So the Educating for American Democracy roadmap focuses on core knowledge and the skills we started with our conversation with, the question of how can learners learn to disagree productively with each other? How can they develop reflective forms of patriotism? So connections to country and to each other that go along with also having clear eyes and being able to be honest about the shortcomings of our society. So that's the big project. And the truth is, yes, I mean, there's a lot of positive reception. And then there's also places where it's harder for some people to accept the reflective part of reflective patriotism. And then there are other places where it's hard for people to accept the patriotism part of reflective patriotism. So right. We're kind of wrangling in the middle there.
Right. It makes me think of one of the big themes that you dealt with in the first part of Justice by Means of Democracy. By the way, I'll link that in the show notes as well. But one of the big themes is the imperative of protecting our differences without domination. Mm-hmm. It seems that a lot of us are trapped in this, I'll call it binary thinking, that because of our differences, therefore we must dominate. Right. It's an either or proposition. Either we have closed borders or we have a welfare state that, you know, mm-hmm. or you can take any number of issues or politicians and see it that way. So what do you mean by difference without domination, and how can we assure that in our at the community level, the state level, at the national level?
Well, the easiest way to put it is to say that I'm an advocate for pluralism. And that is not a new idea. You can go back to the Federalist Papers, and Madison makes the case that if you've got freedom, you've got diversity. And he uses the word diversity, in fact. And that's exactly right.
I didn't know he was woke.
Madison was woke.
Way woke, right? Woke.
Exactly. Yeah. He was the first one, really.
That's awesome.
And he makes the case, yes, that, you know, that's the entire point of freedom, is that people will develop views in their own particular and idiosyncratic way. They'll develop their own cultures of life. That means they'll develop their own communities. And that's what pluralism is about, is seeing that as an asset, seeing it as something that makes us stronger as a society. We don't need ultimately to have a single way of life. We can instead support freedom, foster freedom, so that in fact many ways of life develop. We have to have structures of tolerance in relationship to them, the capacity to disagree productively, and a commitment to using our institutions to achieve societal level decisions that are broadly fair, right? That's where the hard place comes in, when you have to make accommodations or negotiations, settlements. Nobody can get everything in any given decision. That's the challenge of democracy. But so pluralism is really about recognizing that we all bring something to the table from our different backgrounds and cultural experiences. And the goal is to activate the assets we all bring so that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts.
Yeah, yeah. Now, with your part of the Allen Labs is the commitment to renovating democracy for 21st century conditions. And one of the remedies, if you will, that I've heard you talk about numerous times is expanding the House. Yes. So I'd love for you to take some time to talk about, number one, what specifically would expanding the House address? But also, like, as soon as I read it, I'm like, yes, yes, yes. But have you met today's Congress? Like, how do we get that done?
Right, exactly. And do we really want more of them?
Yeah.
So, yes. Well, I do think we should have a bigger House of Representatives than the one we have. And to say that is to say really that the House, when it was first designed, was always supposed to grow and flex and change in its weighting with the changes in the population. And the house did grow all the way up until about 100 years ago, the 1920s. Every census changed the size of the house. And for various reasons, political reasons in the 1920s, because they were having difficulty deciding on a new allocation, if they were going to grow again, they just decided to like give up and cap the house at 435. But the problem is our constitutional system is like an antique clock. You know, those clocks where all the little mechanisms connect to each other, and they all have to be turning at the right rhythm and synced up for the time to move along properly.
Right.
That's the same with our system, because the House of Representatives is connected to the Electoral College. The Electoral College is made up of the same number of people as you have in the House plus the Senate. So when they stopped growing the House, they messed up the Electoral College, because what it meant was that then over the past 100 years, the less populous states have had an ever increasing weighting in their favor in the Electoral College. And that's what's put us in this position now, where it gets to be much more common for the popular vote and the Electoral College vote to go in opposite directions from each other. And so that's like a broken clock.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Yeah.
So, for example, to be clear, you're not in favor of doing away with the Electoral College. You're just in favor of properly weighting it exactly. To have a more representative democracy.
Exactly. And the way to properly rate it again would be to increase the size of the House. So it's just like, let's get the clock gears working with each other the way they're supposed to again. Yeah. Because right now they're not. So it's a fair point. Like, I think if you're not going to increase the size of the House, I think you have to get rid of the Electoral College. I think it's one or the other. You've got to pick. But the mechanism doesn't work any longer because those two pieces were taken apart from each other.
So it's interesting because increasing the size of the House would address the imbalance that's currently present in the Electoral College. It would also mitigate against the excesses that we've seen in gerrymandered districts.
Yep. It would reduce the value of gerrymandering, and so it would help take that off the table. It would reduce the expense of running for office by giving people smaller districts to run in. So it would also mitigate some of the campaign finance issues that we currently have. It means that representatives would know their constituents better. You could avoid the sort of George Santos problem where the district was large enough, like nobody knew he was a fraud. You know, you get back to a smaller district, and I don't think people would be able to get away with that kind of right. fraudulent sort of way of running for office.
And it speaks to what you said before about local news, where yep. if you had more politics reporters on the ground in that district, yep. Somebody could do some investigative work on the leading candidates.
Exactly.
One other thing I wanted to ask you about, the August installment of the series I was talking about in the Washington Post that came out last year, you said, imagine that a truck has crashed into a supporting wall for your building. And it's something you mentioned before. Your building is now structurally unsound and shifting dangerously in the wind. In that abstract metaphor, the building is our constitutional system and social media is the truck. So can you help us better understand what you mean by that?
Sure. No, absolutely. And we talked about this a little bit already, that we struggle right now with really bitter polarization. And at the time of the founding, they did too. They called it factionalism. So they had a different vocabulary, but they are experiencing the same thing. In the years between the Revolution and the Constitutional Convention, they had a Congress that couldn't get a quorum. It couldn't pass a budget. I mean, it was just a mess, very familiar to us, basically. So when they worked on designing the Constitution, one of their goals was a set of structures that would keep that kind of factionalism or polarization from emerging. And the solution, this is the solution that Madison articulates, had two parts. And the part we always teach is the idea that they weren't going to have a direct democracy where like every single citizen was in the public square shouting at each other all the time. Instead, they were going to have representatives who were elected to sort and filter and synthesize and steer in some sound direction for the common good. But the other half of the solution was that these representatives would function in what Madison called a broad republic. And by broad republic, he was literally referring to this issue of geographic breadth and geographic dispersal.
Right, right. Right?
So we're back to this theme where the whole idea was that representation was going to work because people were going to be spread out and split up by mountains and rivers. And so if they had extreme points of view, they weren't going to find each other. They were going to have to get them through representatives. So social media made representatives unnecessary for getting your view into the public sphere. And that has destabilized our entire system of representation. And then when you connect that to things like gerrymandering as well, you find that it's a sliver of the electorate that actually gets people elected into office. And not only that, but that sliver can be fueled by coordination among small numbers of people with extreme views facilitated by social media. So it's really a whole kind of alternative structure of, you know, doing agenda setting work and acquiring steering capacity that's in many ways outside of our structure of representative institutions. And so now we have a kind of combat between the work you actually do through the institutions and the work that can be done through social media structures. And that's, I think, a lot of why everything feels so unstable. It's because it like actually kind of is unstable.
Yeah.
And so we have some design questions to tackle.
Wow. Yeah, I can understand why you would be thinking a lot about AI and how, at the very least, we need to maybe hit pause so that we can better understand the implications and understand the technology so that we can create better, I don't know, roads for all of us to drive on in our civic life. Speaking of which, friends of mine who are designers and photographers have portfolios that include an array of their creative work. And some friends who've done well financially have stock portfolios. You know, the smartest ones having diversified portfolios. You talk about engaging in a civic portfolio. So can you describe what you mean by that and how each of us might think of our own civic portfolios?
Oh, thanks so much for that question, Corey. I love it. So we talk a lot about work-life balance. And we all know how important that is, right? You got to keep work in a certain set of hours and have space for walking the dog and family life and all of that. I'm really an advocate for achieving work-life civic balance. I think we need to have that time we spend with others that's about shaping our society. And that's a little bit different from private time. And I think we need, to bring more intentionality to having, you know, a universe where we can all have a work-life civic portfolio. That partly means we got to get more time away from the workplace, right? Just so we can make time for civic life. But then there's the question of what do you do with that civic part of your portfolio? And right now I'm an advocate for, yes, you know, pitch in with elections, pitch in for your candidates. And in addition, give some thought to the places where you can help make our institutions more functional, where they can be stronger. So in California, there's an organization called CalRCV, for example. It's advocating ranked choice voting. They need volunteers, you know, they need donors. They need people who can go around and spread the message on their behalf. So there are jobs to do right now in the world of democracy renovation. And that's why I really encourage people to see and consider sort of adding to their civic portfolio.
Absolutely. And that's part of why I'm doing this and getting to talk to some of our local representatives, state representatives. I'm always a sucker when one of the candidates says that they're going to be a part of the Problem Solvers Caucus in the California State Legislature. So I have the TPNR question. We've been talking about it the whole time, but I just want to put a point on it. What do you think each of us can do to be able to share space with, have better conversations with, perhaps even nurture relationships with people across our differences? So people who have different backgrounds and beliefs than we do, who get their news from different sources than we do, how can we do better at talking politics and religion without killing each other? Or is it even possible?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. So I'm a fan of a book called Never Split the Difference. And it's a really interesting book. It's written by somebody who helped develop the hostage negotiation program for the FBI. But it's actually, I think, one of the best resources that we can have for learning to have those conversations you just described. I think of our job as being not to let our differences take our humanity hostage. And so that's how I think of every conversation I have with somebody across some kind of line of difference. That's my job, not to let our differences take our shared humanity hostage. So I see every conversation as a negotiation for shared humanity. And the way you do that is you listen empathetically, you mirror back, you check whether you've heard the other person correctly, you know, whether you've understood them before you respond to them. If they've done something that crosses a line, you name it. So, for example, in my email to Mr. Elliott, when I said, yeah, I never do like it when people swear at me, right? I need to let him know that he's crossing a boundary there in terms of what it takes to preserve our shared humanity and so forth. So I think for me, it's going to sound paradoxical, but I rely on hostage negotiation techniques to ensure that we do not let our shared humanity be taken hostage.
I love that. And you're resonating with certain themes that we've talked about on this program. In particular, I mentioned to you before we hit record that David Brooks, his most recent book, How to Know a Person, talks a lot about that. The Braver Angels talks a lot about truly listening and then mirroring back to folks what you think you heard them say. So that's an important part. But also what would have been helpful for me in this interaction that I shared with you earlier was being clearer on my own boundaries.
Right.
And letting someone know in still a neighborly way that they've crossed that boundary, but to be clear about it nonetheless.
Yep.
But I love that, not to let our differences take our humanity hostage. That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. So do you have any questions for me?
Gosh, I appreciate that, Corey. I have so many questions for you. I'm sure we could talk for another hour, to tell you the truth. So, well, for starters, I know I gave you a lot of lengthy answers, so I apologize for that. But I guess I'd love to know, you know, you're clearly thinking hard about the health of our democracy. Where do you see the opportunities, the green shoots emerging?
Oh, that's an interesting way to ask that question. The green shoots, and I love that image because it means it's acknowledging that there's turmoil, there's trouble, right? But but through that trouble, we do see green shoots of opportunity, the green shoots of new growth. Mm-hmm. And I shared one just a second ago. I think I'm encouraged. I don't know if it's still Josh Gottheimer and on the Democratic side and Brian Fitz on the Republican side. I don't know if they're still the two heads of the Problem Solvers Caucus. Mm-hmm. But that caucus is encouraging. I'm always rooting for them to assert their collective voice in the Congress. Because if we could have, you know, four or five or three or four extremists basically hold the rest of the House hostage, we certainly could have 20 or 30 or 40 problem solvers not take the House hostage, but assert a common voice and a common purpose. Mm-hmm. So when a local candidate for our state Senate said that she was one of the founders of the Problem Solvers Caucus in this California state legislature, and now she's running for state Senate, I was a big fan. But also, I think more broadly, not just in politics, but in our culture, I'm seeing more organizations, more programs emerge. A good friend of mine is a woman named Liz Joyner, who started the Village Square, I think in 2006 in Tallahassee. Yeah. Yeah. And she, when she first started in that work of getting, you know, liberals and conservatives together and having healthier conversations, she was one of a very small handful of groups that were doing that kind of work. And now she says there's dozens, if not hundreds, of groups around the country that are joined in this cause. So that's a huge green shoot, I think.
Yep.
So
I agree with that. Yeah, I see that too. I also see that growing and spreading.
Yeah.
So for me, that's one of the interesting things. I think our culture is actually much healthier than our politics is at this point.
Yeah.
And I want to know, you know, how and when do we get our culture back at the steering wheel?
Well, when you tell folks about there was a very, very broad sociological study that was done a couple of years ago that, as it turns out, only about 6% or so of folks on the extreme, I don't like the right left paradigm, but for simplicity's sake, 6% or 7% on one side and 7% or 8% on the other side are what we would think of as extremists. The rest of us, 85%, are what's called the exhausted majority. Mm-hmm. So when I share, I know I have a long title of my program, but when I share that or Braver Angels or Village Square, it's like folks just drank a cold drink of water on a really hot day. Oh, I love that, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot more of us that are engaged in addressing what some of the symptoms are that ail us as a democracy and as a society. But there's a lot of folks that are not just hungry for, but engaged in providing some of those solutions. So that's really encouraging. So before we go, I want to make sure folks can know, how can folks follow you, find more information about the important endeavors you're part of and all the great work that you're doing?
Oh, I appreciate that question, Corey. So the series in the Washington Post that you mentioned, they're going to re-release in a new form as a sort of course that you can do, actually, with action steps and things like that. So you can start to take some of the lessons directly into your own life. That should be out sometime this spring. So I would say keep your eyes on the Washington Post for starters. And then secondly, I would say keep your eyes on my organization, Partners in Democracy, and that's partnersindemocracy.us. We're driving work with democracy renovation, thinking nationally, though starting locally. Currently, our work's in Massachusetts and Ohio, but we have some models for how we do the work. We both reconnect people to their civic power, experience, and responsibility, and then also work to transform institutions so that they're more responsive when people flex those civic muscles. So we'd be delighted to have people follow along both of those two points of contact.
Oh, that's great. I'll be sure to put the link to the Washington Post series, as well as partnersindemocracy.us, in the show notes, so it's easy for folks to follow. I know we covered a lot, and I just like you, I'd love to have you back when the time's right. But is there anything important you'd like to add before we close?
No, just thank you so much, Corey, for your thoughtful questions and the passion that you're bringing to this conversation. It's inspiring.
Danielle, this is a real treat for me, and it's an honor. It really is, because you're so out of my league, and you graced me with
not
your. With your this hour plus has been a real treat for me. So thank you so much.
We're in the same league, the Citizens League. So
the Citizens League. I love it.
All and all for one. All right.
You bet.
Okay.
And as always, if you dig what we're doing here, remember to follow, rate, and review, and tell a friend about what we're doing here. We're really easy to recommend. It's politicsandreligion.us. That's politicsandreligion.us. Or you can find me online at Corey S. Nathan. That's Corey S as in Sam, Nathan, at Corey S. Nathan. Now, go talk some politics and religion with gentleness and respect, and have a great week.